it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Okay, we're joining here with Klee Benally. Klee, you really deserve no introduction, but can you please introduce yourself and give listeners just a little bit of history?
Yate she dene aro shike Klee Benally dasha jene tori chini shabashi china kudene dasha nela shma e beitha chi aro beitha chi dasha che zithajinde na shah. Currently I live in Flagstaff, Arizona. My name is Klee Benally. Introducing my clans, where I originally come from. I hope it hasn't really gotten to that point where I don't, you know, need an introduction, but, you know, this is, I guess, you know, sometimes by nature of just doing the work, that's what happens. But, you know, honored to be involved in your podcast.
Well, hey, thank you for coming on. In fact, you know, somebody that we just interviewed for something completely different said, hey, tell them I really respect the work that they're doing. So we're going to cover a lot of ground. We're going to talk about the recent anti-colonial, anti-fascist mobilization that happened in Phoenix. We're going to be talking about some of the work that Klee has been involved in, the Hall No campaign centered around the Grand Canyon area and surrounding communities. We're going to be talking about police violence in Native communities, and also some really overarching questions. We're going to pick Klee's brain about Trump, about Charlottesville trajectory and action and kind of energy, and where we see that going, and everything else. So let's just get started. Can you tell us exactly what went down in Phoenix, just beyond kind of the media hype? What exactly happened a few days ago?
Well, there was a response to the general call out regarding resistance to the Trump spectacle in Phoenix. There's a history, a context of indigenous anti-colonial and anti-authoritarian slash anarchist collaboration in the past in so-called Phoenix occupied autumn lands. And this was sort of an extension of that, where some folks were looking at the range of calls out that were representative of the typical sort of liberal, you know, non-strategies, if you will, of just, you know, ritual marching in circles and so forth. And so the aspirations of the work that we've done in the past and intentions really sort of were, you know, triggered as part of the formation that we had before and we wanted to continue. So yeah, there was a contingent of anti-colonial and anti-fascist, anti-authoritarian and anarchist folks who held it down, you know, on very specific terms. First, recognizing this is occupied stolen lands and that there are limitations of anti-fascism within that. And so we just wanted to launch another sort of tension in towards a more interesting tendency because of those limitations. And so really what happened was it's a powder keg down there. I mean, Arizona's always been a powder keg. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could look at it as sort of this protracted explosion since colonial invaders came to this area, and we've constantly been at war. It's never ceased, whether it's, you know, white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, and these colonial forces that are trying to dominate and control and exploit Mother Earth and her beings. So this is, you know, just one more phase in this ongoing war against the occupiers. And so, you know, this powder keg was ready to just blow. And, you know, all it took really was a few inspired autumn and Danae Hands to just move the barricades, and the pigs unleashed a barrage of pepper bullets. And that really was where things were triggered. There's a lot of misinformation out there about who started what, which I don't really concern myself with, you know. And ultimately, it's a struggle. It's a battle. And we know what the cops are capable of. It just was, you know, quite remarkable how ready they were to just unleash and, you know, clear out folks with no warning. Like, there was no absolutely no verbal warning. But, I mean, you know, the reality is they don't need one. Right. They're the cops. They represent the violence of the state. And so many unfortunate liberal folks, you know, think it's like a walk in the park, or, you know, but we came for, you know, something different. And so, you know, the dynamics are interesting, because right now the liberal response is like, you know, playing the victim card. It's like, look, this is what the state violence, you know, is represented. But it's not an exception. This has really been the rule. It just manifests itself in different ways. And it really doesn't, you know, unmask itself until, you know, we go against their monopoly on violence. And that's really what the trigger was for this, you know, sort of minor explosion of police violence as it was unveiled in Phoenix on the 22nd.
And were they basically trying to get all the protesters out of there? It wasn't just like a segment of people. They were basically trying to clear out everybody so the Trump people could basically get back to their cars.
Yeah, it was pretty indiscriminate. I mean, initially it was focused on the agitative point of the anti-colonial and anti-fascist bloc. But it just spread immediately. Like, I think that the cops' sort of knee-jerk reaction is like, and honestly, like, I mean, it wasn't just the cops, like, energy. Like, I mean, the tension was boiling over, as I mentioned, the sort of powder keg of white supremacy and fascism. It just needed that tiny spark, and people mm-hmm. just started throwing shit. I mean, people, you know, shit started popping off in different points once the tear gas, pepper spray, the foam projectiles, and the concussion grenades were going off. I mean, just there were just, you know, small battles that were, you know, happening. And as the cops were trying to clear people from the streets, people pushed back, of course, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it just happened everywhere. So, I mean, it was I think it was the way that the cops were already anticipating. They had a foregone sort of, like, you know, probably strategy of, like, if there's any pushback, we're just going to clear the streets. And I think they were already ready to do that to begin with.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that at other communities as well.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. You mentioned the call out. I was just curious if you could kind of explain, why is it important to really hammer home the need for that anti-colonial perspective as well, that basically a critique of, you know, fascism is not enough, especially where we are.
Well, the limitations of anti-fascism on stolen land is just that if there's any kind of anti-oppression liberation that aren't on the terms in regard in a meaningful regard to indigenous people's lands that are being occupied, then it still perpetuates settler colonialism. So, you know, that's a blind spot. That's not just exists with liberal organizing and politics, exists within radical frameworks too. And I mean, it's been addressed, you know, time and time again on different levels. And today there seems to be a really, you know, there's a lot of ground that's been gained because of the work that folks have been doing, the really hard work on both sides with indigenous radical liberation struggler, anti-colonial folks in anti-colonial struggle who've been putting forward those analyses regarding radical politics and shortcomings, and then also folks who've been doing meaningful, like, accomplice work and really sort of getting down to the sort of groundwork and really finding common ground on stolen ground. Basically means you have to build those relationships with indigenous people, and that sort of builds that framework. And that's what's been missing a lot of the times, and that's why it's necessary to put forward this anti-colonial anti-fascism.
Yeah, it's great, because, I mean, so many of the things that have transpired, you know, on this continent, you know, genocide, enslavement, you know, took place long before fascism was even, you know, a preconceived ideology.
Well, you can, one of the statements that I put out recently was, you know, you can be pro-imperialist and anti-fascist. Mm-hmm. So that's not acceptable in terms of anti-colonial struggle.
Right. And I'm, just to go off on a tangent here, you know, in so-called Arizona, you know, existing there and seeing things play out now that Trump has come into office, do you see like part of his base slipping, or are people just in it because Trump represents this, you know, white reaction to different social movements or just the breakdown of society? I mean, are you seeing anything different about just kind of, I don't know, white reactive forces or any sort of kind of right wing reactionary forces in Arizona? Or is it pretty much the same, or has it gotten like worse?
Are you asking if that's not been the status quo of Arizona? you know, I mean, the question of things accelerating on both sides, so-called right, so-called left, on you know, from that perspective, from an indigenous standpoint, it's hard right. to see a difference of right. what, you know, has occurred. I mean, I don't like getting sucked into this sort of dialogue, you know, that things were, because usually the liberals, you use it as a segue into like, well, Trump, you know, well, the Democrats are better, you know, well, Obama was better, you know, this is the worst case. So, you know, like, and now here's our pitch for, you know, getting out the vote bullshit.
Right.
And so what it, you know, comes down to, if we contextualize it in understanding of the ongoing colonial violence that we have faced as indigenous people in this region, then, you know, we don't see any difference at all. I mean, there are the critical components where, you know, if the so-called public lands are under attack, which public, all these public lands and national parks right now that the Trump administration is, you know, targeting for removing those national monument designations and all that. I mean, there's a lot of that sacred lands, and those are hard fought battles for some of not only the indigenous nation, sort of so-called tribal officials, but, you know, indigenous spiritual practitioners and traditional people who've been sort of at the front lines of the sacred land struggles. You know, there is a lot at stake, but, you know, part of that is just recognizing the limitations of the support we have in our struggles for autonomy to regain those lands and protect them for our future generations in the face of, you know, a direct assault. I mean, there's the slow, you know, sort of microaggressions that we face under the Democrats, and here's like the full-on onslaught. And, you know, honestly, you know, we find who really has our backs, who we don't need to explain these terms to when these fights are occurring in the face of this, you know, the fascism being brandished in such an overt way. So, yeah, I'm probably one of the worst people to ask about that. I mean, I know if we talk to undocumented folks, you know, there's much more fear. You know, that is the reality. I don't want to, like, you know, sort of, any way pretend that that's not a dynamic. I mean, because the implications, are really life and death. You know, the implications for Tawana Altum folks whose lands bisected by this, imperial border, you know, that's another reality that, is faced with this escalation, with their lives being threatened, their cultures, you know, being threatened, and so forth. And so, you know, the reality is something that, you know, this is the status quo of Arizona that we faced on different levels with these militias, with fucking neo-Nazis and so forth. It's just, it's great now that people can actually put a name to the fascism, mm-hmm. put a name and articulate, not only recognize it, but recognize, then articulate how they can engage or not in struggle against that. So I think that that's what we're seeing more, is like people who recognize once you're in a heightened state of fear, you lose more options, you know, these options in having faith in the system when all that shit fails and is out the window, which we know as radicals is inevitable. Mm-hmm. But more and more folks, I think, are lining up on those sides, and we recognize we have more people have our backs. How far that goes, we'll see, because, you know, continually, you know, being in this sort of edge and of the margins of the margins, especially as anti-colonial, anti-capitalists and anti-authoritarians, you know, we're the first to be thrown under the bus.
Yeah. Well, we're going to switch gears a little bit. We're going to talk about the Hall No campaign. And there's been a lot of, well, at least some media attention on, you know, what's been going on in Flint. Obviously, the situation there is still ongoing, but specifically about water quality. And I know that, or at least I think that kind of the Hall No campaign started off of really looking at the issues around water in Native communities. Can you just talk a little bit about that? I know, I think you guys like even went to the UN recently, right?
Not folks with the Hall No campaign. Mm-hmm. Our campaign is situated specifically in so-called northern Arizona around the Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. in support of the ongoing long-term resistance of the Havasupai, whose ancestral homelands are in and on the Grand Canyon area, as well as our communities, Diné communities, who have faced the ongoing legacy of nuclear colonialism and the poisoning of our land and our lives. The UN isn't my
sure, yeah.
my battleground and focus. But as far as the campaign is going, really, Hall No is formulated from primarily Diné folks who recognize that the transport route was being unaddressed. There's nonprofit organizations who've been focused on the mining and milling of uranium. And just to put this in perspective for those of you who don't know about our campaign, there's a uranium mine owned and operated by Energy Fuels Resources, who is based out of so-called Canada, and they also have headquarters outside of Denver, so-called Colorado, and they are one of the largest operators of uranium mines and industry in this entire so-called U.S. And so they purchased a mine that's been contentious since the 1980s, since it was first proposed on the south rim of the Grand Canyon. Basically, it's just like 6 miles from the entrance of the Grand Canyon, and it's right at the base of Red Butte, which is a sacred site. It's one of the most sacred sites for the Havasupai. It's their place of emergence in this world, and it's culturally significant to Diné and Hopi nations as well. And so this uranium mine was shut down in the 1980s. Actually, a group called EMETIC, the Evan Mecham, who was the governor of Arizona at the time, this group was called EMETIC, Evan Mecham Eco-Terrorist International Conspiracy. And they severed power lines. You know, they took like awesome liberatory actions, exemplary actions against this uranium mine and helped to shutter it. And it was put on standby and recently reactivated in 2012, 2013, and they're almost to the point where they're ready to start hauling out ore and transporting it 300 miles through Diné communities, which have already been impacted by thousands of abandoned uranium mines. Mm-hmm. We have more than 22 wells that have been closed by the EPA because they have they exceed the radiation contamination levels that's allowable for drinking water. You know, our lands have been poisoned and they've been rendered toxic by the extreme exploitation of nuclear colonialism. And so they want to transport this up to Ute Mountain, Ute territories, or lands at the White Mesa Mill, which is the only commercially operating processing plant for uranium in the country, and it's owned by Energy Fuels as well. And so we, as Hall No, formed to shut down the transport. So we're supporting Havasupai and nonprofit efforts to shut down the mine. They're in litigation in court right now regarding sacred lands and water issues, because the Colorado River is in the Grand Canyon and more than 40 people rely on that. So you can't get any more, you know, of a threat to critical water, life waterways. And right. It's a sacred river, of course. But then you have the threats to sacred lands and our livelihoods. And then coming up, you know, to the Ute Mountain Ute lands and the White Mesa Mill, I mean, that area is rendered toxic as well. And they built that mill on sacred sites as well. And so we've developed basically community action plans. We held a tour in June to basically link up with folks and create a network to engage in direct action, because we know these laws have failed us. They failed us in other struggles to protect sacred sites. There is no guarantee for protection for our religious freedoms as indigenous people when it comes down to this so-called constitution. So we know the failures of this government system regarding indigenous autonomy and cultural survival. And so we've been creating contingency plans to say we're going to shut them down along this whole route. And so we did that tour, and we're continuing our organizing efforts to, you know, prepare to engage to shut them down.
For people outside of the area, where should they go to connect? And like, how do you think that people not living in that region could link up and help with the campaign?
Hallno.org is the website. We're on social media as well, so you can just, you know, search Hallno. But my recommendation is not just to support this struggle, it's to support the front lines are really everywhere. And that's just not a cliched statement or a slogan that we throw out there. I mean, anytime you support indigenous sacred land struggles in the lands that you're standing on, then you further our struggles to stop uranium mines, you know, at Red Butte, for example, or, you know, you help to shut down telescopes on Mauna Kea, or you help to shut down bars, you know, biker bars from being built, you know, by the Black Hills. I mean, this is really how interconnected these struggles are on that basis. And so I highly engage folks not just to sort of like, you know, glamorize or romanticize and fetishize one specific instance. And that really is part of the problem. What we've seen come out of Standing Rock is everybody is rushing to Standing Rock and forgetting about the land they're actually, you know, on and drawing away resources from those critical battles in many cases have been waged for decades. And so I highly, you know, recommend folks finding ways to meaningfully engage to support indigenous sacred land struggles and water struggles where they're at, more so than just sort of like try to parachute out or support. That being said, if folks want to contribute resources in other ways in support or bring folks out to speak about this issue, you know, that's one of the things that we're trying to do is, you know, we recognize that these sacred land struggles are the physio-spiritual front lines in the struggle for our existence, not just our cultural survival as indigenous peoples. And so, you know, part of that, when we get to that understanding, especially with cross sections of different struggles, and, you know, some people call it intersectionality, but really it's the work that is necessary if we want to exist in these fights against these extremely, extraordinarily violent systems.
Well, you brought up Standing Rock, and before we were talking, before the recording, mentioning this is it's coming up to the 1 year anniversary. What do you see as the major lessons with the No DAPL struggle, and also perhaps the limitations that came out of that? And basically looking back on the struggle at Standing Rock, what do we need to learn from it in order to go forward?
That's a really
huge question.
Long, yeah, a very hard topic to unpack. You know, and I'm not I don't would ever complain to be, proclaim to be, someone who can speak, you know, from any position in representation of what's really occurring in Standing Rock. I wasn't there as long as other folks, but I've been in at the front lines of other sacred site struggles. Since I was born, you know, my relatives come from Big Mountain and Black Mesa, where they're still to this day resisting for more than 40 years, forced relocation at the hands of the U.S. government in congressional law PL 93-531, you know, at times in the face of armed, federal and tribal agents. And so, you know, this is very much a sacred sites and water, you know, struggle in resistance to resource exploitation, particularly Peabody Coal Company in that area. And so the perspective that I have comes from that, you know, and it also comes from the lessons that we learned and did not learn out of Idle No More. You know, a lot of folks, as I mentioned earlier, part of the critiques that were waged against Idle No More and that relate to Standing Rock is like a lot of folks, you know, took a vacation, went up to Standing Rock and left the struggles back home behind. For example, here in the city of Flagstaff, there was a crew of folks who had, you know, had a pipeline of support up to Standing Rock. But for 20 years, we've been fighting to protect the San Francisco Peaks, which is a holy site to 13 indigenous nations, from ski area development and snowmaking with 180 million gallons of treated sewage that they wanted to dump, you know, through a pipeline that they were building up the mountain. And so we engaged in direct action. We, you know, just sort of all the tools that we had available in the toolbox, we engaged in that resistance. And so a contingent of folks who had been doing No DAPL support tried to get the city of Flagstaff to pass a resolution in opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. And those of us who were engaged in the sacred lands defense here said, oh, hell no. We're not going to let that happen, because the city of Flagstaff still to this day maintains a contract to sell that wastewater to snowball, and they benefit from that. So if you're going to have them on one hand say we oppose, you know, desecration of Lake Oahe and the Dakota Access pipeline, but at the same time they're profiting off of the desecration of a mountain that's holy to 13 indigenous nations here, you've already failed. You know, that your movement has failed because it stops short in understanding, you know, the sort of primary contradiction of where we're at as indigenous people in the struggle against these colonial forces. And that really was it. It's just, you know, superficial understanding of what it means to defend the sacred when the front lines are everywhere, because as indigenous people, we have that relationship where we are, where we carry that forward as that relationship to the sacred, to our sacred places as well. And so there's a lot more shortcomings. I mean, we have everything from, you know, the sort of, you know, the vilification of how Red Warrior camp and society were vilified, you know, and the movement policing that came out of that and how that sort of was popularized. We also have the nonprofit exploitation, which, you know, to this day is now a sort of never ending, no dapple fundraising gala, you know, in many circles. You know, when, you know, we have more than 600 people that were arrested and where are their cases now, we have Red Fawn and other folks who are still captured by the state. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of work to be done, but a lot of the nonprofits seem to have just moved on with their climate justice agenda, when that agenda, you know, excludes for the most part an understanding of what it means for indigenous liberation on these lands, on our terms. You know, that the ally formations that came out of that with organizations like Showing Up for Racial Justice, Surge, you know, just sort of profiteering regarding, you know, social capital that is very much the currency of the ally industrial complex. You know, I mean, all of these dynamics we see sort of, you know, hyper materialized in this configuration. And a lot of that came out of Idle No More. Like Idle No More, a lot of folks showed up for a round dance at a mall and then went shopping afterwards, you know, after the 15-minute round dance was done. And there was no meaningful, you know, engagement in the ongoing struggles. Not to say that, you know, those steps didn't move in a good direction to wake people up and further engage them on a critical level against colonialism, capitalism, and so forth. But, you know, what has been the lasting meaningful impacts? And, you know, we have these lessons, but unfortunately, we're not really engaging in that critical discussion that should recognize that, you know, Standing Rock was in many ways a strategic failure or a tactical failure. You know, and the one question that has to be asked that qualifies that is the pipeline stopped? And if you can't say yes, then there was a failure. We can count the other victories that are around that regarding the coalesce, how the movement coalesced, how there's more attention now given. But, you know, if you're comfortable with the gains won from the politics of recognition, then the dead end of that is where the same dead end of identity politics gets you. Mm-hmm. And that's just a seat at the table with the colonial authorities still in power. Whereas if we're engaging from a framework of the politics of liberation, you know, then we configure ourselves differently with our so-called allies or our actual accomplices. We implicate ourselves in a way that the outcomes of that battle isn't just people, you know, counting their social media accolades or their foundation checks, but we can count it in a way the metrics of it changes, because it's the metrics of actual movement and liberation.
Do you feel with the various pipeline battles that have kind of emerged post Standing Rock, there is at least an acknowledgement of kind of the traps, either of nonviolence or, you said, like the ally industrial complex or any of these things that really kind of held back No Dapple?
Two degrees. I mean, you know, it's hard when we sort of do these calculations and our analysis is in the only reflection we have is like based upon like social media, like who likes and who shares what sometimes, you know, mm-hmm. like the real sort of like, you know, results, I only count with, you know, who has our backs, who's in the streets the next time we put these calls out, you know, for anti-colonial mobilizations and so forth, or for sacred land defense. And, you know, to me, we're still sort of like looking at small steps in those gains. You know, I've, you know, I had these same conversations with other folks who are engaged in sacred lands battles, whether it's Medicine Lake with Pitt River and folks in so-called Northern California, and whether it's folks resisting the Loop 202 freeway in South Mountain, threatening to desecrate autumn lands outside of so-called Phoenix. You know, we have all these same conversations in a lot of these indigenous sacred lands defense. And it's hard to say, you know, it's really hard to say, because it's we see the consciousness raised, the awareness, but we see the shortcomings of it when it's actually time to do the hard work, the proactive work,
right.
the shit work, where you have endless meetings, you know, and you're like counting your fucking like pennies to figure out what resources you can get together to, you know, keep your website going or whatever, you know.
Well,
so I don't want to, you know, paint a picture of doom and gloom, but I think we need to have these real fucking conversations if we're going to get anywhere and really analyze where we're at, because a lot of it's not strategic. It is very reactionary. And you know, a lot of it is, you know, reform based, you know, there's this sort of like self assimilation and neocolonialism that, you know, stops short with these decolonial, lifestyle projects. When, if we look at it from an anti-colonial struggle standpoint or an anti-colonial analysis, and we want to abolish these systems of oppression that, are perpetuated through colonialism and other sort of pillars of white supremacy, and with capitalism and, heteropatriarchy and so forth, then we start, you know, counting our victories in a different way. Our metrics changes. We do the calculation and the results. We have to be that much more critical.
We'll switch gears once more. Let's talk a little bit about all the organizing work that you all have been putting in against police murders of Native people. And just in general, what do people need to know about the realities of police terror and murder and violence against Native communities in the U.S.? And also in regards to where you're organizing currently.
So the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice has stated that the, quote, the racial group most likely to be killed by law enforcement is indigenous people. You know, and this isn't to argue or identify, to argue that our oppression is more severe. But, you know, I think it's a point to recognize that our shared struggles, or that we have shared struggles, to ensure that there's not one more Sarah Lee Circle Bearer, Corey Kenosh, or Paul Castaway, Alan Locke, Mahavist Goodblanket, John Williams, or L'Oreal Sinogeny, which is, you know, an issue that really hits close to home, because just 40 minutes away from here in Winslow, last year, L'Oreal Dene woman was shot down, you know, six times close range by a fascist cop named Austin Shipley. And so in Arizona, actually, we lead that statistic if you look at it from that standpoint and see legitimacy in those metrics, that we face the most repression as a racial group for Arizona. I think we accounted for a majority of the police murders last year in Arizona. And specifically so-called Flagstaff, we're talking to you from today, out of over the past 5 years, we look at the statistics or the data that was collected from the Flagstaff Police Department here. And what they found, what they reported is that every year they average about 5,000 to 7,000 arrests. In a town of about 60,000 people, including 15,000 or so that are part of the university. So they're a pretty sort of like fluid part of the population. But indigenous people comprised half of those arrests. So that's about 3,000 to, 2,000 to 3,000, maybe a little bit more arrests of indigenous people. But we only comprise about 12% of the population. So that's about, we have a population of about 6,000 to 10,000 indigenous people who call Flagstaff our home. And so if we boil that down, that's one in every two indigenous person faces arrest in this community on a yearly basis. And that's like, you know, counting young people to elderlies. And this statistic, unfortunately, is a shared one in the so-called border towns around the borders of the Navajo Reservation. Dinepikeya is our ancestral homelands are within the Four Sacred Mountains. But, you know, the reservation boundaries, we have these sort of border so-called border towns that were set up initially as, you know, sort of capitalist outpoints, frontier sort of military forts, really, and trading posts that were set up, and they still perpetuate these racial, you know, racist dynamics that we see today, especially in the terms of state violence, in the disproportionate targeted policing that we face as indigenous people. You know, so we look at those statistics and we say, well, either one in every two of us or half of us in this community are criminals, or we got a targeted policing problem. And yeah. We're not willing to accept that we're fucking criminals because this system is illegitimate and based upon, you know, the colonial imposed laws to begin with. And so this is the violence that we face. You know, this structural violence is ongoing, and it is something that's completely obscured. You know, the politicians here gloss it over, and they attribute it to, you know, the sort of transient population and the high rates of folks coming off the reservation because alcohol is outlawed. There's a prohibition of alcohol on reservation lands. And so they're saying, oh, well, a lot of people come here to drink. And we're like, fuck that noise, because, you know, there are a range of other folks who are fluid through this community too. And they would enhance the same sort of inform how the statistics are adjusted. So we're coming to terms with that reality that indigenous bodies are still policed on that extreme basis because of the threat we pose to these colonial systems.
Switching gears to a little lighter subject. A lot of people listening to this, or at least some of the people listening to this, have heard of your musical work in the band Blackfire. I'm hoping you can update people just what musical projects are you working on, and also if you can please tell us about your film.
Oh my gosh, after talking about like all these issues, don't make this about like, oh yeah, and you're an entertainer. Do you have anything to share and sell with everybody? Like, I mean, so I actually stopped playing music in 2012, I think, when it was clear that a guitar wasn't going to stop a bulldozer from desecrating the holy San Francisco peaks. You know, I was like, okay, I spent 24 years on stages, you know, like ranting, you know, my diatribes about, you know, the indigenous and rallying people around indigenous liberation resistance. And you know, there's limitations to that. And so, you know, right now, I don't know if I feel comfortable, you know, aside from directing people towards indigenousaction.org. So indigenousaction.org is where, myself and a small collective of folks, we focus on, putting out as much critical analysis and perspective and providing coverage to a range of issues that aren't getting the attention. Sometimes there's a pause in the work that we do because we do a lot of behind the scenes work. We do, web and graphic design development. We also do strategic planning, direct action training. One of the things that we're really excited about doing is we're, doing, indigenous rooted direct action training. So we're stripping away the NV from the DA, the nonviolence from the direct action.
That's awesome.
You know, it's necessary because yeah. on the base level of the analysis, it's like it perpetuates, well, one, it reinforces that there's this sort of the polarization of violence where and that doesn't serve anybody because violence exists on a spectrum. And it's not, you know, and it perpetuates a sort of good, you know, protector, defender, protester versus bad, you know, protector, defender, protester. And it's much more complicated and beautiful than that. And so, you know, we're trying to stimulate that with the work that we do. So we do a lot of shit behind the scenes. We invite people to engage and support our efforts by, you know, checking out, whatever we produce on there. I do make films, I do make music, but, you know, I'm not interested in another musical career. So I set that shit aside and I only do it when I feel like, you know, if I don't do it, it's going to explode. And I share that out there, but, you know, I'm tired of hanging out with musicians after 24 years. You know, we're good at aesthetics, but sometimes the actual on the ground shit is where more people are needed. So, you know, it's great to have cheerleaders. It's great to, you know, build and promote, you know, sort of create great optics around cultures of resistance and liberation. But, you know, that's only a shell if there's nobody to fill that.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm more interested in organizing, agitating, in provoking, and fighting is fucking fiercely and hard as possible, especially, you know, given how escalated shit is and how this sort of beautiful space that there's this tension right now. It's almost like a resonance, like when you strike a string on a chord and it's vibrating so hard that it starts vibrating other notes around it, and it almost becomes like this violent agitation. I mean, that's where we see the destabilization of the liberal, like, fucking, you know, environment. We see the destabilization of, you know, folks who have been on that sort of fence, if you will. And, you know, it's a beautiful ground to disturb, because it's a growing tremor that I think if we can rattle those cages, rattle those notes, like, that much more. And I'm not dismissing or discounting, you know, folks who are, you know, focused on the arts component at all. It's just, I've been there, done that. And I don't want to sort of, you know, put out there, oh yeah, here's my CD, go buy this.
But you did direct a film.
Yeah. I actually worked in conjunction with another organization that I helped to form called Out of Your Backpack Media, which is Indigenous Youth Response to the Need for Media Justice in Our Communities. And so a lot of the youth that I've mentored with that project helped to create the film, and it specifically tackles the forced relocation and the identity of being a relocation refugee from your own homelands because of coal mining, because of the U.S. enforced laws. And, you know, just looking at power relationships beyond, you know, what we see, because, you know, we look at symptoms and we treat them a lot, but, you know, the radical in me always tries to pull people to the root causes. And, you know, that's what we tried to do through this movie. It's called Power Lines, and it's not available yet. We're looking at setting up screenings in different places. At some point, there'll be a DVD, and we'll stream it somewhere. People will probably pirate it, and we'll be happy about that.
Okay, cool. And just to come back to kind of a broader thing you mentioned, I find that, you know, myself included, most settlers, most white people, most Americans really have no idea just the amount of extractive industries and like land grabs that are still happening in native communities that are, you know, supposed to be sovereign governments. And I don't know, just it blows my mind. I think most people have no idea. They think that, oh, they're just getting a check from a casino or, you know, whatever. It's just their own thing. Like, it has nothing to do with the United States. And I think most people have such a disconnect between reality that land is still being taken. There's still a ton of resources being taken out of these areas.
My response to that is, this is part of the failure of the so-called climate justice movement, as an example of where, you know, shit can be worked on. And global warming, from their perspective, is the greatest crisis facing humanity, which is true. But if you look at it from an anti-colonial indigenous perspective, and, you know, that's sort of heavy words to just sort of rearticulate what my father, as a traditional Dene Hatathli or healer, says, is that global warming is a direct consequence of the war against Mother Earth. You know, it's a question of what side we've chosen or we found ourselves to be on, or what sides then we are ready to choose in this conflict. When we understand things on that terms, and we see that war happening everywhere. You know, the Bay Area is just a horrendous exception. Finally, folks have woken up with an anti-colonial understanding to honor and not just recognize, but honor in a meaningful, active and proactive way for Ohlone people. But, you know, where is that same support for Tongva or Chumash or Kumeyaay folks in occupied so-called LA? You know, the obscurity of indigenous struggles is part of the responsibility of folks engaged in radical, you know, anti-politics. And, you know, this is not to say we're arguing priorities for anybody, but to understand that, you know, we don't have a choice but to wake up every day and face the reality of this ongoing war brought upon us by colonialism. And it hasn't ended. There is no post-colonial in this existence for us. If we want to survive, we have to understand it on those terms. And if we can, you know, manage to agitate and engage people in a way that they wake up to understand that and make that choice to be at our sides, or in a way engaged in the struggle that understands that at the end of the day, when we have liberation against heteropatriarchy, when we celebrate liberation against white supremacy and capitalism and fascism, all forms of fascism, that we have to meaningfully understand and honor the land that we're on to in that relationship. You know, it's not a one-way relationship. The earth knows us. We understand how to live with the earth. And these aren't just some colorful words. These are the teachings that we have since time immemorial. And this is what is under attack, you know, in our very existence. So the trauma, it has to be healed. And it's beautiful to see that folks are willing to fight back, you know, fuck the political narrative, of the political narrative battles. You know, we frame this in the struggles that we face every day at the front lines, and that's where it really matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're gonna transition again to some kind of overarching kind of looking forward questions, but I know we don't want to frame everything in terms of Trump, but I'm gonna frame this question, I guess, in terms of the Trump timeline. But I mean, just looking back at, you know, the past 8 months, or just kind of 2017 so far. I mean, you've talked a little bit about this kind of acceleration on a multitude of sides, but just, you know, what are your thoughts so far? I mean, what's your kind of analysis of the time that we're in? We're going to talk about kind of like post Charlottesville and all that stuff in the next question, but just looking back at this year so far, what are you thinking?
I think I've told you most of what I'm thinking. Sure. You know, I've been very intentional and selective of what I like choose to post, or the analyses that I articulate. Especially when Trump was, made that quick announcement that his first rally in the West was going to be in occupied Autumn lands in so-called Phoenix. I didn't want to put anything out there, write anything. I just wanted to organize. I wanted to see how dirty I could get my hands. And I'm interested in getting dirt as far up under my fingernails as possible until they bleed. You know, I'm not afraid of the splinters. And that's where, you know, my passion is right now. Like we could talk, we could sort of dissect and sort of like regurgitate the range of analyses that we have, but they're, you know, in what ways can we, how long can we sort of spin those same wheels about the arguments of white supremacy and how fucked up it is, and colonialism and how fucked up it is, and heteropatriarchy and how fucked up it is, and so forth. You know, to the point where, you know, is it about addressing the miscalculation that's being done by the dominant social order, or is it about addressing what ways we can be as effective as possible? And I'm not interested in dulling any edges and the fierceness that have come from rubbing for years against stone, you know, to sharpen these edges. You know, I'm trying to find ways to be as sharp and help sharpen as many other folks as possible, as they find their way in this battle, in the range of battles against colonialism. So, you know, I think that that's the critical point where I want to be in. I know it's colorful and it's almost sort of evading, you know, a great opportunity to present some great slogans or catchphrases to address this, but we have the tools that we need. We have the analysis that we need. Mm-hmm. You know, I think what's really critical right now is a settler consciousness, an understanding of what it means to engage in anti-colonial struggle on a meaningful basis, not just for, you know, non-Indigenous folks, but for our folks as well. You know, decolonization has sort of been rendered, you know, lifestyle, sort of like personal project, by many folks, and that kind of declawing is what I want to attack. Mm-hmm. You know, developing an understanding of anti-colonial struggle on the terms of Indigenous people whose lands we're on, to the point where we can articulate attack and what that means. You know, that's where we need to have these conversations, you know, around fires, you know, with these circles and growing these circles to the point where we destabilize and attack and undermine these the institutions and ideas that are the underpinnings for this dominant social order. So I don't know if that helps to respond to your question.
Yeah, that's great.
This is how the U.S. is supposed to work. It's the design of the U.S. And I'm not interested in these discussions about like America and its ideology and, you know, I mean, the liberal discussions that are even happening within, you know, the radical sort of like, you know, sections of these struggles. I mean, really, it's like hearing people regurgitate chants of like, we're all immigrants in like a black bloc or like, you know, Nazis go home.
Yeah.
Like, no, you know, we need to be way beyond that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, this is a good time to have, you know, that conversation or have that argument, because, you know, the media, the centrist media, the liberal media aligned with the Democratic Party is definitely, you know, turning on anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial movements, which it always has. I mean, like you said, this isn't anything new. I mean, they're doing what they're designed to do. But just looking at the energy that's been unleashed with Charlottesville, I mean, there's just been so much. I mean, people have literally torn down Confederate statues. There's been waves of vandalism attacks against all sorts of vestiges of the Confederacy and also colonial monuments to, you know, missionaries and everything. I mean, there's just been a lot of stuff that's happened over the last 2 weeks. Do you have any thoughts about, you know, where this should go or just any thoughts at all about, you know, this kind of period that we're in?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the day when we celebrate that all the hands of oppressed people have worked towards dismantling this monument of colonial violence called America. I mean, if we're not understanding the institutional, you know, elements of this, I mean, then we're going to just do window dressing by having designations by the state handed down with proclamations of indigenous people to stay, or like, you know, basically just the window dressing of removing these monuments. I think that there's something, I've written about this before, but I haven't really published it broadly, but, you know, there's something certainly, you know, powerful about the psychic solace that we get. But if the state dismantles the statues and proclaims Indigenous Peoples' Days and so forth, then what have we actually achieved if these structures and systems rooted in colonial violence remain intact? You know, this political posturing diminishes, I think, the liberatory agitations. And, you know, I'm interested in going farther, you know. You know, we apply this to our understanding of, and I want to bring this back to sacred sites because it's critical. You know, our sacred places are our sort of monuments of relations that we have maintained since time immemorial and are integral for our continued existence, whether it's Lake Oahe, whether it's Mauna Kea, whether it's Medicine Lake, whether it's South Mountain, whether it's Mount Graham, you know, Red Butte, the San Francisco Peaks, and it goes on and on and on. You know, these are the critical junctions in the battle against the pipeline, the Dakota Access Pipeline. Not many people could articulate what the understanding to defend the sacred really was on those terms. And so, you know, these sites, these monuments that we maintain are being attacked by these same political forces that are decrying select facets of their past transgressions, you know. But, you know, there are telescopes, ski resorts, pipelines, mines, skyscrapers, and other effigies of oppression that are continuing to desecrate or threatening to violate, you know, our sacred places right now. And I'm not interested in shutting down momentum. But if we critically engage and multitask, I really believe that we can go much further and it'll be much more interesting to address, like, you know, the questions of intergenerational trauma, historic trauma and suffering that are represented by these statues to conquistadors. You know, for generations, there have been folks in so-called New Mexico who have cut the foot off of one of the statues to a conquistador, Oneite, in representation to his suppression response to the Pueblo uprising, which is a powerful form of indigenous resistance that's obscured through colonial history. You know, and I'm interested in sort of destabilizing where these conversations are happening, whether it's in media forums, you know, nonprofit paternalism or academic explaining, you know, to understand that ultimately it's just about pulling weeds and to make sure that those weeds don't come back, understanding that they have to come up from their roots. And so that's why I say, you know, I'm interested in that day when we all celebrate that the hands of all oppressed people have worked towards dismantling this monument of colonial violence called America, because it's not just one monument that needs to come down. This whole project called the United States of America is a monument of colonial violence. And we understand that history. We don't need to unpack that. You know, we don't need a fucking, you know, academic thesis funded by nonprofits or whatever, you know,
right,
projected out there. It's like, we understand that because this is who we are. Mm-hmm. It's how we've come to be. It's a question of if we're going to define our future on our terms for our future and coming generations. And that's really the struggle, I think, of how we need to sort of like understand and move forward. But you know, these are just the conversations that we need to have face to face, you know, beyond the Twitterverse and social media. You know, mm-hmm. These are the real conversations that we have to have and articulate our position and to be able to have that understanding of how we engage in anti-colonial struggle to bring these systems down.
Awesome.
I don't know if that answers your question, but I mean, it's just some of the shit that we've been working on.
Great. Well, on that note, is there anything else you want to add? Encourage people to check out the Hall No campaign, see how you can help out, see how you can get involved in your local area, check out Indigenous Action. Anything else you want to say? Any shout outs? Anything else you want to plug?
I just want to thank you and folks who are on the front lines in struggle against fascism. It's interesting that it took the alt-right agitation to turn Antifa into the next Occupy. the beautiful thing is that I think we're in a very interesting position. Those of us who've been engaged in anti-racist action organizing and anti-fascist organizing for years, and mm-hmm. you know, the range of different like sort of associated anti-authoritarian projects that come along with this sort of range of identifiers, being anarchist, so forth, radical, that we have a lot of lessons already learned. It's just a question of the way that we approach and engage on a critical basis, you know, and not necessarily just saying, oh, we need to be strategic, but think things through and engage meaningfully on a basis that we can have each other's backs rather than here's another moment. It's superficial in relation to how we've chosen to engage with our brothers and sisters and other relatives in this struggle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very skeptical, you know, when folks, you know, are well-meaning and show up and they want to tear down all the statues. You know, my question is, well, how far do you want to go? And one of the questions that we're asking here in so-called Flagstaff is, what does anti-fascism mean in Flagstaff? What does it look like? Anti-fascist resistance mm-hmm. and organizing. What does anti-colonial anti-fascism look like here? Mm-hmm. How do we want to shape its meaning? What other voices do we need to have in that articulation so we can come up with something meaningful to engage in as effective attack as we can?
Contradictions, opportunistic dialectism in a shit ton of overly academic terms. Caught in the afterthought, repackaged all the regrets that you had bought and were just tracing the damage patterns. And now we're just tracing the damage patterns. Did you forget where you came? Existential but not consequential. It's essential but non-denominational. And bipartisan don't mean shit in this imperialist context. And fuck the system and the ship that brought it in. Decolonialism and aboriginal sin. And 500 years later we still resist. And it should be unsettling. And it should be very fucking unsettling. Just going in circles.
just tracing the damage patterns. All the ashes scattered where our fields once stood, and they're still reading between the lines, searching for something good. But there's nothing redeeming here. This ain't no song for redemption, so fuck your reform and straight abolition, yeah. Fuck your reform and straight abolition. Did you forget where you?